Hello and welcome to IndieInterviews.com, part of the IndieFeed.com network, a weekly radio show where we interview independent musicians to get their perspective on their music, their history, and the world around their art. On this show, your host Garrison Reed sits on with John Vanderslice. John discusses the development and management of his studio, Tiny Telephone, the impact his love for film has had on his music videos, and making records like a craftsman.
We should locate this interview. We're sitting in a Chevy Express van outside of Gypsy Tea Room.
In Dallas, Texas.
And isn't this comfortable? Isn't this a great place to do an interview?
It's great.
Better than backstage, you know?
Definitely. Yeah.
Since moving to San Francisco, the artist, photographer, studio owner John Vanderslice has made 5 solid records and toured the U.S. extensively with Death Cab for Cutie, Beulah, and close friends the Mountain Goats. Here is a snippet of Exodus Damage, a remix track from the 2005 release Pixel Revolt. John has just finished a nationwide tour and will soon begin work on his next record.
Yeah, I guess let's start talking about the remix and your love for hip-hop.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How did that come about with Anticon?
Well, we put some few... They asked me to give a short list of people that I wanted to have do the remix, and Anticon was, like, right up at the top, you know? And...
This is Barsook asking.
Yeah, Barsook asked me to do this. And they have a... you know, especially when that Y record came out, you know, they have this great, like, hybrid thing of, you know, they kind of have one foot in some prog rock stuff too, you know, and I just thought it would be a really, really nice, like, marriage, you know, and Alias did an incredible job on that mix. We've been chatting, you know, emailing each other, and, like, you know, I think he's pretty amazing, and it made me want to do more remix stuff. The thing about remixes is that you don't do anything, and it's like, you know, and
you have
no
control over it.
You have no control over it, which is incredible, and also that you just don't have to worry about it. Someone else does it, and in almost no other case in something I'm involved in do I not have to do it myself. So it's pretty amazing.
Like the Dismemberment Plan remix album. That's so good.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's interesting. So I was just actually on the Dismemberment Plan site the other day just to kind of see what, you know. See what people were up to and get updates and stuff.
There's a few tracks off that remix record that I think are as good, if not better, than the originals.
Yeah,
and that's kind of the fear that I guess of being getting remixed is you're like, what if people like it more than
definitely.
I guess when you moved to San Francisco, well, you didn't move, you started the studio.
Yeah.
What was your aims with the studio?
Well, in the beginning, I knew that I needed cover for my expensive recording habits because I, like, came out of, like, four-tracker, you know, basement heaven. And then when you leave that world and you start graduating into tape decks and like, serious multi-tracks, like 2-inch 24-track decks, first off, they're difficult to maintain. They're expensive to buy. And when you start, like, the problem with upgrading gear is that everything else in the signal chain has to be upgraded. And so it was very clear to me that if I was ever with my, you know, I was a waiter, you know, at the time.
Yeah.
Right? So if I was ever going to put together a recording studio, it was going to be under the guise of having a business model and have some, like, revenue coming in. I mean, in some bizarre way, the entire, like, business model of Tiny Telephone was to just have cash flow enough to be able to buy the things that I wanted. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like, I knew that I was never really going to be truly profitable, but I just wanted to have enough money coming in so I could juggle credit cards. And also, when you have a business, you can then take out bank loans.
Yeah.
It wasn't until maybe the fifth year of being, you know, an owner of Tiny Telephone where I could actually go to a bank and get a bank loan. And then I borrowed, like, shitloads of money.
Yeah.
I borrowed, like, $75,000 and bought an Eve console and a Studer tape deck. My friends were telling me I was clinically insane. And there were many nights that I went to sleep thinking that I was like a child, you know, that I was like a, like, there was something wrong with my, with my, it was like a hobbyist gone crazy, you know what I mean? Like, and
when you're investing, it's, or when you've given loans, that's a threat and a risk that you're
it's unbelievable. I'd never borrowed so much money. Now, for me to borrow $50,000, I wouldn't even lose 3 minutes of sleep on it because I'm so used to carrying debt load. And that's good and bad, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, but the studio became successful because it needed to pay for its overhead. The studio has been a great experiment for me in owning a business, and that it has basically paid off all its loans. And Tiny Telephone is a very rare recording studio. It does not have any outstanding debts now.
We were talking earlier and you said that you don't have, if you have two dead days, that's bad.
Yeah.
Do you have any criteria about people coming to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, if I get a hint of machismo or drug stuff or like amateur hour stuff, you know, like, not loving amateur hour of, like, a weekend warrior band, but, like, a band that is, like, rock and roll, and they've, like, they want to live Motley Crue's The Dirt, right?
Yeah.
And they're going to take that into your studio, and they're going to, like, they're going to fuck with your life. Can we cuss, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I know we probably can, but maybe you don't want me to. Maybe you guys are like some Mormon subcult and you're like getting like very upset at me right now. I don't know.
No.
I would say very rarely, my whole thing, my own aesthetic is that, and people ask me, they've asked me this, like, there's almost, I guess in some recording studios, there's almost like some aesthetic criteria with which, for me, we're like an emergency ward or like a dry cleaners. I mean, we are there to serve the client. And the more disparate the music is, the more weird, bizarre, off the path. We've had bluegrass. We've had gospel. We've had a tennis instructor come in and play love songs. I mean, like Captain Tennille style love songs. Was one of the most pleasant things to be around ever. And then we've had super credible bands come in and make everyone's life misery, you know, miserable, and make a bad album. So you just never know what's going to happen. So for me, I want people who are really like have a realistic and positive relationship to music. Because some people, they'll bring in and they'll project their own unhappy, you know, connection to music, or their own like totally happy connection to music. And it matters. The reason why it matters is that there's $200,000 or $300,000 worth of gear in there. And if someone acts weird or funky or, you know,
that's
fucked
what
up,
keeps you up at night.
Yeah, it keeps me, absolutely, definitely. So in there, the only people I've ever discouraged are people that were who on the phone were just sounded like they were trouble. And I've just kind of gut dodged. Or people who have canceled time in the past or who have been nervous about booking days, like they can't make up their mind, or I mean, it's just too busy for me to worry about
Golden
stuff.
Golden Gate Park, walked our Mondays there, safe inside a replica. They have a garden there. Climates of the world are laid out on a walking tour. You were my proof. You were my wetsuit. I will be okay. I can keep the
read an almost in every interview you're talking about Hitchcock and
yeah.
all these films. Do you, you haven't made very many music videos, but do you have this desire to take your songs and the visuals of the songs that we have yeah. into film?
I would say definitely not. And the reason is that I think that because I pussyfoot around videos because I'm such a film fanatic, you yeah. know, like we've had talks with kind of heavyweight video people. Well, in my world, heavyweight, not yeah. like huge famous people, but Scorsese. Like people who were doing like real videos on like film stock. And yeah. like, I think look
when
really
I
great.
I read the, you're going to try to do some sort of 32 millimeter.
Oh yeah. I think we're doing some more videos. Yeah. Okay. And they're going to be filmed. Yeah. And we're working now with this this guy, Brent Chesanek, who's fantastic. And he did the last video, Transmanual, that I think is incredible in Super 8. And the thing is that I gave him kind of a directive. I told him, basically, I said, make there be no connection whatsoever. I said, okay, we talked about Transmanual, and we kind of came up with this theme that it was about the destructive qualities of love. Now, that's not necessarily all of what the song is about to me. To me, it's about bringing democracy to Iraq, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's okay that he got that out of that. That's perfect. And that's a perfect, like, one-sentence tag to take to, you know, storyboard it out to yeah. whatever you want. So he made this video that has no connection whatsoever to the location, you know, Iraq, and the interaction between the two characters, which is a writer, a journalist, and a prostitute. And he made it almost like a metaphysical story about the creative spark of fire. And I don't know if you've seen the video or not. It's totally amazing. And it's like a metaphorical, you know, short film. And I love it that there's very little connection between the song, because I think that if it were closer, then I would have trouble with it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. because then it would have to become more specifically connected to the narrative, you know, but
it would steal some of that. The fact that he took a totally different perspective than you,
yeah.
and you're cornering it.
The problem, yeah, no, it's that's you're right, definitely. The problem with videos for me is how much they cost.
Mm-hmm.
This is the problem, and because I've been so, I'm a micromanager, and I managed myself for a long time up until about 6 months ago when Adam, my booker, started managing me, and he's incredible. He's done mm-hmm. an amazing job, but because I managed myself for so long, and I was doing the books on my own accounting, it was very clear to me that video, a budget for video, was absurd compared to other things that you could do.
Yeah.
You know, like other things that you could do for your, you know, hiring a radio publicist or whatever right. it is, or hiring now people are hiring publicists that go directly to blogs that are a separate publicist, you know, like doing other promotional things other than spending 10 grand on a video.
Yeah.
I mean, we were getting quoted like just costs for some of these videos. You know, some of these guys will give you a serious break, and it's like 7 to 10 grand.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just, you have to sell a lot of records to justify spending that much money, you know.
Have you talked with Ben since they went on their video splurge?
No. Oh, yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's amazing because because Death Cab for Cutie's on Atlantic, they have a marketing budget that they can bill back to the label. And I don't know what percentage they actually is recoupable, but these guys can really get serious money coughed yeah. up for them, you know what I mean? And also, they sell a tremendous amount of albums.
Yeah.
So for them, it's like it's a fantastic way to spend money. And I mean, shit, Autumn DeWild did a beautiful video for them, and I've known Autumn, and Autumn will do a video on the next record, but even that video, which was done on, like, you know, it was a digital DV, you know, shot, and it was done at a school, very, you know, no paid actors or anything, it still costs, for me and my, in terms of my money, a lot of money. So,
yeah.
And that's a great idea, but I definitely think they got Atlantic to pony up for that.
And if you were to film your own videos, how would you approach it?
I mean, I would get obsessed because I've always wanted to be in movies, you know what I mean? I mean, I would... Who knows? I mean, it might change my life, you know?
Yeah.
If I even got any sense of like what it was really like to start shooting film, you know? I mean, yeah. it just might really change everything for me, you know?
Yeah. I saw Lifeboat the other day.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's totally amazing. It's a great movie.
What's your favorite Hitchcock?
Well, there's a lot of great Hitchcock movies, but on the playing the other day, I saw Young and Innocent, which is a really early Hitchcock movie. It's like a British film. It's like before 39 Steps, and
it's all part of those like bulk DVDs that
yes,
are kind of crap.
Exactly. Yeah, and they're it's all public domain stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, I've seen most of those because you buy them. You know, you're flying and you have to sit on the plane for a long time, so you need like 20 movies. You know. And
it's most financially.
Yeah, it is totally. So I bought all of them, all those Hitchcock box sets. I've like seen every Hitchcock movie, you know. But that movie is really, really good. It's a great early Hitchcock movie. But I just like movies in general. Like I have a wide, like I'm not like, I really like high art stuff, and I like total junk, you know. Like it for me, they fulfill so many different roles and so many different needs in my life. It really, it can be anything, you know.
Lifeboat, other than the fact that it was a Nazi.
Yeah.
It could be any river, any body of water.
Yeah.
And then same with Rear Window. You know, it could be any room in any city.
Yeah.
And there's kind of this universalism.
Yeah. Yeah.
That could relate to the songs that you're writing.
Absolutely. Yeah. He has this archetypal thing. And also he has this wonderful thing of like of setting people in motion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like
the MacGuffin.
Yeah. Yeah. And
it's a Hitchcock class.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic.
So cool.
I mean, it makes you realize that like there's a real function to like basic romantic comedy. Like that Punch Drunk Love fulfills, you know, these basic archetypal needs of a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
Is very interesting, you know.
I guess could we talk a little bit about the tour track, the two track recordings?
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you been doing that? This is the second time you've done that?
It's the first time, actually. The first, the cellar door version of this was called MGM Endings, and it's remixes, like heavily kind of instrumentally leaning remixes that Scott Solter did of the album.
Okay.
That Scott Solter and I did of the album. And he's the main engineer on all my records. And, like, basically we would just go in and try to obliterate these songs as much as we can. Some are totally unrecognizable. And then with this record, we're actually doing a remix later on that it may be vinyl only that's going to come out in the fall. But we're just too slow. He's been really busy. And so for this time, we decided that the thing that we wanted to bring out on tour was a completely reactionary version of Pixel Revolt. Pixel Revolt took 9 months to record, and it was heavily overdubbed and it was kind of like conceptualized, you know, for better or for worse. Scott and I would like write all these notes, and then we try to fulfill these kind of aesthetic markers that we mm-hmm. lay down, depending on the narrative and what the song seemed to need at the time. And that may be a mark of, you know, smart, creative people, and it may be the mark of really pretentious people with too much time. I really can't be the
bad
one to
scientist.
Judge that. Yeah. So the thing is that when that was finished, it was really, it just was a grueling, long, and kind of numbing, you know, series of sessions, you know. And so after that, since we always sell tour-only records, like that's, every tour we've always had something that's tour-only.
Mm-hmm.
First, we like to, like, have something that's just numbered and collectible. And second, it's incredibly good for the merch table to have stuff that's only for sale on tour. And indie bands exist on merchandise. Like that's how they're mm-hmm. bread and butter, you know, that's where they're paying their wages, you know. And so as a reaction to how long it took to make Pixel Revolt, we decided to do like a one session, just basically a one take version of Pixel Revolt live with acoustic guitar. And we just chose this room where Tom Waits has done a lot of records. He's done Bone Machine there. It's a very particular sounding, like, it's a chicken coop, basically. It's like a cement room that was like a chicken room in this farm. And it has old pipes. I mean, it's funny. It's like a cliche of a Tom Waits room. It's like what you would imagine Tom Waits would record in.
Like, you know, so there's like chains and things.
Yeah, and like farm implements on the wall, things to bash, and like, I mean, it's like a joke. You know what I mean? And there is like a radiator where you can tell that someone used it as a percussive device. And we know the studio owner up there. It's in Cotati, and where we did all the Mountain Goats records too. And it's just like a. It's like a, you know, someone's, it's like a set version of like a Tom Waits room. And so we did the record live to two track up there, and I loved it because we did, for what, we went up there one day and cut a record live. And it's all on Suddenly It All Went Dark, which is like a shout out to that, to Jason Molina and that killer demo disc he did with the first Magnolia record. It's all about lyrics and melody line, and that's it. And I love that the songs are then hinging on something very different. It's no longer about the texture or the sonic or the recording or whatever window dressing you want to put on it. It's just stripped down. And when we did that, I think it's going to change how we approach the next record, because there's no way we're going to make a layered record like that again.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a band record. It's not going to be like an overdub record, you know?
I kind of thought, when I read it, I was thinking like, it reminds me of, if Ben were to go back and do the all-time quarterback.
Yeah, absolutely. We were talking about all-time quarterback today in the band. Yeah, absolutely. It would change it. Definitely.
Or if Connor would go back and do Fevers and Mirrors or something like, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's good when you do go back to, like, you know, previous ways that used to work, you know, because sometimes you don't really get necessarily smarter about what you do, you know. But definitely the next record will be affected by doing that session.
We talked about kind of how immersed you are in blogs, and I read in the interview for the DCS that you just have a distaste for, I guess, digital photography and digital recording.
Yeah.
And it's like this paradox of, I really want to care for the grassroots of it all.
Yeah.
And then I really can't, I don't like people taking photos in the show with their crappy cameras.
Well, actually, I do like when people take photos in the show.
Just not you taking photos.
The thing is that it's not a projected aesthetic criteria. It's just, it's for my own, you know, like, I'm a hobbyist, you know what I mean? Like, and like every tweaked out hobbyist, I have my process, you know what I mean? But, I mean, it'd be very difficult for me to say that there's masterpieces being made on digital recording. There are. There's tons of great sounding albums. It's just that for my own way of working, it rubs against something that I believe in aesthetically, you know. And I think that I've seen so many bands that have a very clear aesthetic idea, and then they just, the years and the pressures from outside erode that. And it could be about anything. It could be about writing good lyrics. It could be about, like denying melody line in your music. It could be anything. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying it's a specific route, but the thing with digital, the thing is that digital is killer at certain things. It's great for the speed and the ease of it. I accept MP3. I used to run an MP3 hub.
Yeah.
When Tiny Telephone was an MP3 hub, you know, it had like that, the whole all-time quarterback record was actually posted on Tiny Telephone for years. I love high-res MP3s. I love them. I think that it's the most unbelievable, you know, beautiful, magical, efficient thing in the world. The idea that I can have a file on my server duplicated millions of times without depleting that one file it's incredible to me. It's amazing. But the thing is that for me to make, you know, records and to shoot photos, I'm like a craft guy. I respect that the camera that I carry around, the Leica, took 50, 60 years to perfect, and that film took 50, 60 years to perfect. And I know that the 24 track was 70, 75 years in the making. You know, a lot of geniuses spent a lot of time figuring out how to make this work and write. And not everything that's related to film and to analog recording is good. Most of it is terrible, actually. You know, but the thing is that on the top level, that shit is unbeatable. And yeah. you kind of got to respect it. You know what I mean? Like, and I, but I know why. If I was a concert photographer, would I be shooting 35 millimeter or like large format Hasselblad or like, you know, yeah. slide? I don't think so. You know what I mean? Like, I am realistic. You know what yeah. I mean? And, but the thing is that I sell my records for $12 at the merch table. And I think that I'm owe people that buy them that I do everything in my power to make sure that those records are good on as many levels as I can cover. And Sonics, for me, that's something I've been interested in since I was like 14, you yeah. know? So, I mean, it is a paradox, and people, my friends are baffled sometimes. They think that I'm like totally full of contradictions, and I yeah. probably am, you know? The thing is that the MP3s and MP3, I mean, what could be better than going to a website and actually hearing music? The you know, part of what I mentioned in DCS is that a review in Span or Rolling Stone is totally meaningless. And I totally stand by that. In fact, I got a lot of emails about that DCS thing. Like, people really, it got under people's skin. Yeah. Some people were really jazzed about it, and some people
like
were...
label people, or...?
People savvier than label people. No offense, you know what I mean? But, yeah. but, like, people who are really, like, grassroots, paying attention to stuff, and, like... And, but, you know, there's still old media people that are not really super jazz. I'm sure you guys know that. You guys are working in, I mean, you know that there are old media people who are resistant to blogs. And the thing is for me is that you go to a blog and there's music is there. That's the whole point, right? That's mm-hmm. what we're talking about anyways. You know what I mean? It's incredibly, like... It's perfect. It's yeah. the perfect marriage, you know? And, like, the bands that I've discovered through reading Span Rolling Stone, zero out of how many years? Like, none. Yeah, not yeah. one
like,
band,
like
right?
They won't make a move anything until it's, like, until it's so safe, until it's been proven. It's like,
yeah.
And it's so contradictory.
And also, the inefficiency of, now, is there anyone there that I actually trust enough to go out and spend $15? But the thing is that if I'm reading, like, you know... I know Chris's aesthetic. I read Chris enough where I know what he likes, yeah. and we overlap in huge chunks of what we listen to. There's a music file there. There's a link out to the website. In 5 minutes, I'm completely immersed in this band's world.
Yeah.
And especially if the band has their shit together.
Yeah.
You know, and that's incredibly efficient. So for me, it's like MP3s, blogs. It's like that's top level. Film... analog recording, it's yeah. top level. They don't necessarily clash with each other. You know what I mean? Like I still do believe that if you can have the best resolution albums upstream, and then if you do put that through a, you know, the most efficient compression codec that you can, you know, like a high rate MP3, mm-hmm. you know, that it matters. Just like a scan of a Cartier-Bresson photograph looks good, even though it's a scan of it, you yeah. know, like, I mean, a Radiohead MP3 still sounds pretty fucking good. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's so it, but it is a contradiction. And I do have insight that there is a bullshit part of it. You know what I mean? Like, I do feel that there's a novelty kind of divisive, almost like a baiting part of my argument. Yeah. And, the only thing that's kind of on my side about with the studio is that I've actually lost a lot of money because I don't pretend to love digital. Because bands are very afraid of linear formats. They don't want to have to reveal who they are and what their singer sounds like and what their guitar player can string together in 16 bars. Mm-hmm. They want the comforts of cut and paste and auto-tune and corrective surgery.
Thanks for listening to IndieInterviews.com, a weekly podcast where we interview independent musicians. More information about our guest today, John Vanderslice, can be found on his website, johnvanderslice.com. Music samples in the show are from his 2005 release, Pixel Revolt, is available now on Barsuk Records. For information on this release and previous John Vanderslice releases, please visit barsuk.com. For information, including a transcription of this interview, please visit IndieInterviews.com. For feedback on this podcast and the materials used in its production, send your thoughts to indieinterviews@indieinterviews.com. Thanks again, and see you next week.